Are you looking for answers to life's biggest questions like, who are we? What does it mean to be a human person? What does it mean to be a Catholic in America today? How can I be a prophetic voice in our culture? The Center for Faith and Culture at the University of St. Thomas in Houston now offers its MA in Faith and Culture online. This program transforms students by immersing you in the historical, cultural, and theological patrimony of the Catholic tradition, so that you'll go out into the dominant American culture and leaven it with the good news. Students can audit courses, get an 18-hour certificate, or go for the entire MA program. For more information, Google Center for Faith and Culture, the University of St. Thomas. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Dr. Stuart Squires. I'm the Associate Director of the Center for Faith and Culture and Associate Professor of Theology at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. The Center for Faith and Culture, celebrating 25 years, brings the Catholic voice to the ongoing conversation about the meaning of life and the liberty and pursuit of happiness we hold in common as Americans. Today's guest is Dr. Victor Sines. Dr. Sines is the Executive Director of the Houston Institute and a lecturer in the Rice Philosophy Department at Rice University. He completed his PhD in philosophy at Rice in 2018, where he wrote a dissertation on Aristotle's account of the moral virtues in the Nicomachean Ethics. His research interests include ancient philosophy as well as ethics and bioethics. First of all, Dr. Sines, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to talk about a variety of things, but around the question of moral virtues. And the reason why I want to talk about this today, I think, is because, and I'm not the only person who've said this, is that we live in an overly litigious society, and that certainly means there's a lot of court cases.
Yeah.
But I think we have a litigious mentality.
Yeah.
To put it briefly, I think we have become the Pharisees that Jesus criticized in the Gospels.
That's
so
right.
I think the antidote to this litigious mindset is virtues.
Yeah.
Of course, Aristotle's the probably the greatest philosopher who ever wrote on virtues. So I'm looking forward to this conversation.
That's but be great.
Before we get to that, why don't we start with a brief biography of Aristotle? Who was he and why is he important?
Sure. No, of course. So, you know, it's funny that you want to start there. You know, philosophers, especially philosophers nowadays, tend to be so much about the argument. You know, we often forget that there's a real person behind the argument. So Aristotle lived squarely in the 4th century before Christ in Athens. He was one of Plato's all-star students in Athens, even though he was born in what is now Greek Macedon, Stagira, you know, hence his nickname is Stagirite, right? So why is Aristotle important? So it's one could ask this question as meaning important to whom, right? So if we're thinking about important for philosophers, if you were to draw up a list of the top five philosophers, whoever wrote anything ever, you know, he's on the list, uncontroversially. I don't care who you are, right? Mm-hmm. And I think secondly, if we're looking at the Catholic tradition, you know, I'll get this from the angle of the Center for Faith and Culture, you know, Aristotle is a absolutely central part of the Catholic tradition. To speak to the first of these aspects, you know, it's funny if you look at philosophy in the 20th century, especially ethics in the 20th century, and you just have this like list of all-star philosophers who draw their inspiration from Aristotle, right? So this just goes to show that not only was he important for what he said, but he's important for what he still says to us today, right? And this is important also in the Catholic setting, as we see, especially in the example of Aquinas. But that's just a little bit about what's...
Before we get to... And I do want to get to the importance for Christianity and why Christians have embraced him and should we do that.
Yeah.
Let's just get back to your first point about he's on the top five list.
Yeah.
So what did he do that makes him on the top five list uncontroversially?
Oh, my goodness. So... you know, he arguably He's the first to develop a system of formal logic. He was basically a kind of empirical metaphysical biologist. So he's going around, you know, studying all these different animals and classifying them and all these different things. So the current taxonomy, of scientific taxonomy of animals, we draw from Aristotle, right? Most of the major arguments for God's existence in the Middle Ages, which are still invoked today, come from Aristotle. You know, one of the three major ways of thinking about ethics in the 20th century, we draw from Aristotle, right? One of the major traditions of political theory that, again, still invoked today, we draw from Aristotle, and on and on and on and on and on, right? So I think if we were to name a single philosopher that was most championed in the Middle Ages, actually, I don't know that I want to qualify it that way. One of the most championed philosophers in the Middle Ages. I'm looking at all the medievalists and the Center for Thomistic Studies, sure, would cringe at this thought. Aristotle is surely among them. And if you look at the early modern period, the whole early modern project, one way to think about this is precisely as a rejection of Aristotle, mm-hmm, right? And, fast forwarding again to the 20th century, in folks thinking about ethics, which I like to think about a lot, there's a big chunk of philosophers who see themselves as saying, hey, we need to recover the thought of Aristotle. So why is he important? Because of his absolutely unparalleled influence. I think that's one way to think about this.
Aristotle was a pre-Christian Greek philosopher, but you've already mentioned Christians like Thomas Aquinas drew on his philosophy to help shape Christian thought. But of course, some Christians like Martin Luther, who called the Catholic Church the Aristotelian Church, and he meant that as a slander, believe that using Greek philosophy corrupts the gospel. Why is it okay or even important for Catholics to rely on non-Christian thought in general, but Aristotle in particular?
Yeah, good. So, what's interesting about Martin Luther, and I'm not an expert in theology here, but I think what's just clearly the case is that he's presupposing a certain account of human nature, right? And of course, that the question, central question, becomes is, well, is that account of human nature true, right? He's also presupposing a certain view about the powers of human reason. And I think there, at its root, we just have a radically different reading of sacred scripture, right? So why, to your question, why is it desirable, for Catholics to look to Aristotle, and not merely permitted but desirable? I think in doing so, we're just following the example of the early Christian fathers, right, who try to take the very best of pagan thinking. What's interesting about philosophy in the Hellenistic period after the death of Aristotle, you have all these schools arising, where philosophy is not just seen as an academic discipline, but it's very clearly a way of life. Mm-hmm. Arguably you had that even in Aristotle's own day, but it's almost like you have these philosophers, and I'll get to the Christian bit in a moment. Yeah, this philosopher is almost writing like self-help manuals, right? So you had the Stoics, the Epicureans, the Skeptics. It's like, hey, you want to be happy? Here's how you become happy. Get rid of all these desires that are making life hard for you, or just conform to the nature of the universe, right? It's all fine. Don't worry about it, right? So you get the early Christian father saying, hey, yeah, that's all that great. That's all great. But here's the real philosophy as a way of life, right? And they very self-consciously see themselves as taking a place where, this is the true philosophy as a way of life. And at the same time, they say we can draw the very best from pagan philosophy for our thinking. So if nothing else, I think it's not at all an exaggeration to say that Luther is at odds with that, to that way of thinking, right? And I think why is it good to look to Aristotle? In a way, we're just imitating the example of the early Christian thinkers.
Is there anything in Aristotle's thought that should make Christians hesitate?
You know, so you get, so some people are natural slaves, you know, women are naturally inferior, you know, there's, you know, manual work is, you know, demeans the powers of the mind, you know, those are probably some of the, you know, most common charges pressed against Aristotle. But I think, you know, what's beautiful about the Catholic tradition, and this gets to reading Aristotle in a moment, what's beautiful about the Catholic tradition is that it recognizes, as it were, that reason has its own domain that's intimately related to, but must be oriented towards the truths of revelation. So all this to say, what does it mean to say that reason has its own domain? Is that it can fail by its own standards. Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example, right? So if an argument is question begging, it's like, I don't need to appeal to the goods of revelation to show mm-hmm. you that that's a bad argument. So I think when reading Aristotle, you know, Catholics should see someone from whom they have a lot to learn. But at the same time, you know, they're not reading sacred scripture, right? So they should be very willing and ready to engage their powers of reason. And this should lead us to see, well, look, we know women are not naturally inferior. We know that there are no natural slaves. You know, we know, and. So I think there is definitely a lot to benefit from reading Aristotle, despite the fact that some of these things might need correcting.
Foundational to his ethics are virtues. I already mentioned that earlier, specifically the four cardinal virtues: prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. What are they, and why were they so important for Aristotle? Why did he spend so much time talking about them?
Yeah, no, good. So you mentioned the cardinal virtues. What's interesting, and to me was very puzzling, was that it's very clear that even in Plato's day, you know, and prior to Plato's day, there's this, you know, tradition of you know, the major virtues or whatnot. It's fairly clear that these are regarded somehow as special. But what's interesting is that when you get to Aristotle, he doesn't give you just four cardinal virtues, but he gives you four cardinal virtues and then some, we might say. So he's got like 10 virtues in his list. But so to actually answer your question, so even though he doesn't refer to them as such, you know, it's very clear that prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance have a significant role to play in Aristotle's ethics. And I think one, you know, there's lots of ways to look at this, but I think a right way to look at this is, for Aristotle, is what really brings the genuine good of the human person? You know, what's genuinely going to make a person happy, right? So, and this is at the core of Aristotle's thinking. And it turns out that, on his view, if you're going to make a person happy, you need to help that person act according to his nature. Okay, Victor, that's high and abstract. What does that have to do with the cardinal virtues, right? So it turns out that, you know, reason is what makes us distinctive from animals. It is by the use of our reason that we think so as to make choices. That's prudence. You know, when we make choices, we inevitably do so as the social animals that we are. You know, we are, Aristotle famously says, by nature, social or political animals, depending on how you translate this. So our duties to others are matters of justice, right? This is not something imposed from the outside, but we are just the kind of animal that works in groups. You know, right? As I sometimes like to say, following the work of one scholar, her useful turn of phrase, we're like really complicated bees, right? It's like you never really think of, you know, the good of a bee in isolation. You know, mm-hmm. it's always the good of the bee within the hive. Sure. So our duties of justice, right, emerge in part from our social nature, as I read Aristotle. Then we get this whole business of our having desires that we share with other animals. So, you know, so we've got famously our appetitive desires, food, drink, and sex, right? So that's where you know, Aristotle tells us about the importance of the virtue of temperance, right? We're not, you know, he famously dismisses, you know, the life devoted to sensual pleasures in like one line of the ethics, saying, well, gee, you know, if I live my life oriented primarily around food, drink, and sex, it's like, you're kind of confused about the kind of thing that you are. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're not an animal, you're a human, mm-hmm. right? So, and there's much higher goods and even how much higher pleasures mm-hmm. that you can draw from this. Finally, you know, about courage, you know, so similar to our desire for pleasures, we have this kind of spirited element in our soul. You know, it's, you know, primary way in which this is manifested is anger, right? So, and again, this is something like food, drink, and sex that we share with other animals, right? So I think we speak intelligibly about dogs getting angry, you know, we speak intelligibly about, you know, dogs or other animals having a sense of hierarchy, right? It's like, where do I fall in the hierarchy? Oh, somebody's, you know, taking my place. I'm the alpha dog. Don't you get it? What are you doing, right? So, you know, these reactions to threats, whether to ourselves or to those in our community, are ultimately matters of justice. So, again, even though Aristotle doesn't give you the four cardinal virtues in so many words, these certainly play a central role in his ethics. You know, more virtues beyond that, but I think the key idea is to say, look, you know, Aristotle is looking at the kind of animal that we are, as the kind of metaphysical biologist that he is, and he's asking what makes for the thriving of mm-hmm. the human person. So that's his point of focus.
You mentioned several times that he's comparing us to animals, yep. and in our secular culture today, we often do that. They, you know, rejecting the idea that we're created in the image and likeness yep. of God. A lot of people, and I'm sure philosophers yeah. in particular, say, well, we're just a different type of animal.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's what Aristotle was doing. He wasn't just, yeah. I mean, obviously he wasn't reading Genesis and using that language. But I guess my question is, yeah. when he compares humans to other animals, yeah. how is he doing that differently than how we often in 21st century America
yeah.
compare animals and humans? How is he doing that differently?
Yeah, no, good. So it's hard for me, you know, as I sometimes tell students and friends who are not philosophers, you know, sometimes I feel like you spend enough time reading philosophy, you lose a grip on whatever intuitions you might have about what the wider culture does or doesn't think, right? So I'm not sure how much I can tell you about the wider culture's views about humans as animals. But I can say this, is that for Aristotle, the distinction between the human animal and all other animals is not just a difference of degree, mm-hmm. it's a difference in kind, mm-hmm. right? So it's not just like we can do, you know, other animals can do X and we can do more of X, mm-hmm. right? We've got something that's, you know, absolutely in a different category, right? The powers of reason, in his view, puts us just in a totally different category. Mm-hmm. There's, you spoke about Genesis. You know, there's some highly controverted passages in Aristotle in the De Anima, which later thinkers read as Aristotle affirming the immortality of the soul, mm-hmm. right? Precisely because of the way that powers of reason are different, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a non-theological argument for the, you know, persistence of the soul after death. Was that actually Aristotle's view? That's harder, but there's a good case to be made, right? Okay. And in some ways, it's not surprising given that that was Plato's view, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't have a strong view about right. this, but there's certainly the rudiments of a highly sophisticated argument for the immortality of the soul there, and that's how a lot of the later tradition will read it. But to your questions, major difference in kind, and okay. not just difference in degree. Okay.
I guess one example I was thinking of, back in the 90s, you might remember, there was a woman, she wasn't mm-hmm. even trying to protect animals, she was actually yeah. protecting trees. She climbed up a tree in, I think it's Seattle or Washington huh. State somewhere, and she lived up there for like 2-3 years. And she did that because to prevent lumberjacks coming in from cutting down the tree. So in other words, yeah. she's willing to sacrifice her life
yeah.
for a tree.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's coming out of a particular way of understanding the human person and how we aren't any different. In fact, in that view, it seems to me saying we're less than trees. And, you know, some people thought she was kind of a little off the reservation a little bit, but there wasn't any sort of fundamental critique of her way of thinking about the human person. And to me, that's always stuck in my mind of symptomatic is the way our secular culture thinks about the human person today, that we're even less than trees.
So what would Aristotle make of that case? I'm not sure, but I think here's something where here's the kinds of considerations that he would certainly want to put in the forefront, right? So especially given our nature as social animals, right? It's like you and I have all kinds of obligations to all kinds of people, right? So Aristotle talks about what we owe, you know, our parents, right? Precisely because they have given us so much. You know, Aristotle talks about what we owe our teachers, you know, precisely because they have given us so much. He talks about what we owe our local community, the polis, for him, right? So there's this strong sense of like, I think here is a point where I think I can put my finger on this. I'll get back to trees in a moment, but here's a point where I can really put my finger on this, is that I think it's certainly true that here's a view that has very wide purchase in the culture. So much so does it have wide purchase that there's empirical studies that confirm this. So like there was this series of studies done by, you know, the sociologist Christian Smith, whom you might know, so he's a sociologist at Notre Dame, and he's looking at emerging adults, you know, 18 to 23 year olds or so, and, you know, the underlying vision of the human person that many of these emerging adults seem to hold is something like the paramount good is like radical autonomy. I can do whatever I want with my life. Mm-hmm. And it's nice if I want to help other people, but it's not much more than nice. It's certainly not required. Getting back to Woman in the Tree, you know, I don't know if this was her view, probably not in so many words, but that view in the culture that has such wide purchase is certainly consistent with what she's doing. It's like, right. Hey, if you want to spend your life trying to defend a tree, that's just fine. You know, I'm certainly not saying that, you know, ecological considerations are not worthy of mention. They surely are. But where Aristotle might have something to say is like, hey, you know, you also have lots of obligations to lots of other people. Mm-hmm. And those hold whether or not you think it would be a nice thing to do.
Right.
So I think that, you know, he would bring some of that into the table.
Are you looking for answers to life's biggest questions like, who are we? What does it mean to be a human person? What does it mean to be a Catholic in America today? How can I be a prophetic voice in our culture? The Center for Faith and Culture at the University of St. Thomas in Houston now offers its MA in Faith and Culture online. This program transforms students by immersing you in the historical, cultural, and theological patrimony of the Catholic tradition, so that you'll go out into the dominant American culture and leaven it with the good news. Students can audit courses, get an 18-hour certificate, or go for the entire MA program. For more information, Google Center for Faith and Culture, the University of St. Thomas.
Definitely, we 21st century Americans aren't big on obligations these days. But let's get back to virtues. Yeah. I sort of mentioned our sort of legalistic mindset. Mm. I've often wondered, and I doubt that there's statistics on this, but thinking about Fortune 500 companies, you know, how many lawyers work for Fortune? I mean, maybe thousands and tens of thousands of lawyers work for Fortune 500 companies. And I wonder how many ethicists work at those Fortune, you know, and they're so rich that they obviously could afford one ethicist if they wanted to. Yeah. So should Christians attempt to shift our public discourse away from legality and towards a virtue, a mindset of virtue? And if so, what would that sort of look like?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That's a huge question. But I think here's, you know, there's a philosopher whose work I like, who puts it, I think, in useful terms. So this is, you know, Christian Miller, who has done a lot of work on character. He notes, I think, usefully that when we're talking about virtue language, even though it might seem a little bit arcane and removed, it's generally the case that it's often closer to home than we think, right? So if you think about, you know, if you have a sister, maybe you do, maybe you don't, you might think, okay, what kind of guy do you want your sister to marry, right? You know, what kind of father would you want him to be for, you know, your sister's children, right? What kind of children would we want? What kind of people would we want our children to be, right? So this is all virtue language, right? Or I should say it's not quite yet virtue language, but it is speaking to considerations of character, mm-hmm. right? So I think that's a place where I think lots of ordinary people who might not be Christians, who might not be Catholic, who might not be philosophers, can recognize that the kind of person we are matters a lot, right? And I think even in a highly pluralistic society like ours, you know, I think we should not be shy of making claims like, yeah, it's good to be a good citizen, right? It's like I don't think I'm not imposing any major moral claims on people, at least not in a way that I don't think is invasive or contrary to our broader culture, right? Mm-hmm. So it's good to be well informed. It's mm-hmm. good to be truthful. It's good to be respectful of others, right? It's good to be that kind of person, right? So I think I don't if only, right? So I don't know how much philosophers can do for politicians, but I do know that, you know, so you and I are in the business of the university, right? So I know that for sure we can try to be a good influence for our students, mm-hmm. you know, whatever their views are. And I think making the very explicit connection in the appropriate context, right, to questions of citizenship is also important. It's like, hey, look, listen, like when you get out there, you're going to have to deal with people of all kinds of persuasions, with all kinds of beliefs, and you need to live together and flourish together, right? You're going to need to be a certain kind of person mm-hmm. In order for you to do that, right? So I think, you know, what would it look like to shift our public discourse in that direction? At the very least, it would mean changing the characters of the people who are involved in the discourse. So I think that's one way to start thinking about this.
Well, let's take one example that's sort of certainly on the university campus. You just sure. mentioned we're both at the university level. Alcohol consumption.
Sure.
It seems to me that we're always having sort of legalistic discussion. Mm. You know, at what age should someone be allowed yeah. to drink?
Yeah.
But, you know, if we were to shift from that sort of, you know, should it be 21 or should it be 18? Yeah. You know, why can you go to war at 18, but you yeah. can't, you know, drink alcohol till you're 21. How would that debate itself and our society in general be shifted if we came at it from a virtue perspective rather yeah. than that legalistic perspective?
Yeah, no, good. Thank you. So I think, and here I'm very self-consciously aware that what I'm about to say is broadly Aristotelian, but of course you're not. Aristotle has plenty to say about temperance, but how this applies to 21st century, you know, university culture is a different story. So I think, you know, a couple of things that seem to me worthwhile. So I think shifting from the legalistic mindset begins to really shift the question to what kind of person do you want to be, right? So this is less a matter of do I play by the rules or not, but it's about what kind of person am I becoming, you know, through the choices that I make, you know. It's like, well, I hate to break it to you, kids. You're going to have to live for yourself, you know, for the rest of your life, right? So, you know, choose wisely if you want good company. So I think even from the perspective of just the student himself, mm-hmm. you know, let alone his peers, it's like, you know, you... if, you know, presumably there are things that you want out of life, mm-hmm. or presumably even there are things that you think you should want out of life, even if you don't want them, right? Yeah. Maybe you think you should want to be a good citizen. Maybe you think you should want to be a good spouse, a good husband, or a good wife, good father. You know, that kicks us back to the question, what kind of person do you want to be, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's similar to the case with alcohol consumption. I think that's one way to shift the conversation. I think a second way to shift the conversation that's maybe less obviously about virtue, but I think at its root it is. So going back to this idea that we are, you know, social animals, you know, so here's a consideration about the law that I think just about anybody is going to grant, whatever their views are, you know. So law shapes culture, right? So law shapes the way we think. Law even shapes the way we feel, right? And, you know, whether that be, you know, law, you know, federal law, state law, or even we might say campus quote unquote law about this or that, right? So I think in addition to the question of what kind of person do I want to become, it's also, well, what impact do I want to have on the broader culture, right? You know, somebody might say, well, I don't really care what kind of impact I might have on the broader culture. But there I want to say, well, look, you're either a social animal or you're not, right? If you are a social animal, you know, you should be well aware that, you know, you need these communities to flourish in order for you yourself to flourish, right? I think it's a beautiful sign of maturity to be able to recognize that. So even if a particular person might disagree with the drinking age or whatever, they might still be guided by considerations of what kind of person do I want to be? Mm-hmm. You know, do I want to be somebody who, you know, is able to look out for the common good and not just for my individual good? Mm-hmm. Do I want to be the kind of person that's able to respect legitimate authorities and so on and so forth, right?
So several things that you've mentioned several times already. Yeah. We are a social animal. Yeah. What kind of person do you want to be? What does it mean to flourish? Yeah. Community.
Yeah.
Obligation, responsibility. Yeah. What kind of citizen do you want to be?
Yeah.
All of these things now are at the forefront in our discussions about how do we react to government restrictions because of COVID.
Oh, sure.
And just how do we be a good citizen, you know, wearing face masks, what not wearing face masks.
Oh, my gosh.
has Aristotle come to mind in the past few months as we've been addressing all of those things that you've sort of, in a sense, been talking about? What would Aristotle have to say?
Oh, my gosh. Thanks, Stuart. Oh, gosh. Has Aristotle come to mind? You know, actually, so it's funny. So I taught a course on Aristotle's Ethics this past semester. We read the Ethics from top to bottom. Most of the assignments were fairly traditional assignments, you know, papers, exams, and so forth. But the last, very last assignment was an op-ed, you know, so I gave him some guidelines for writing an op-ed, and it's like, wait, hey, look, you know, apply, you know, one or more ideas of Aristotle's thinking that we have been studying this semester, and apply this to some aspect of contemporary living. And of course, we were like in the middle of a pandemic. I guess we're still in the middle of a pandemic. We're in what seemed to be like the beginnings of a pandemic at the time. So I had students tell me all kinds of very thoughtful things about Aristotle and COVID-19.
Sure.
You know, everything ranging from, you know, what would it look like to put the virtue of generosity, you know, at the core of our thinking about COVID-19, right? So, you know, there may or may not be controversy about what the data does or doesn't say or whatever, but I think things look very differently if you're proceeding not from, I want to do my own thing, but from, how do I actually help and serve others, right around me? So that was one bit that a student mentioned. Another bit that I thought was thoughtful in thinking about our obligations to others. It might seem a little bit counterintuitive here, but, you know, one student talked about, you know, in connection to COVID-19, talked about the epidemic of loneliness, right? And kind of striking, this student mentions, you know, it's like, well, gee, you know, it turns out that if Aristotle's right, you know, if I want to feel less lonely, you know, I need to be a better person, right? He doesn't quite put it this way, but it's like, I need to be friendable, right? if and I need to be the kind of person who others would want to be friends with and who can actually follow through in being friends with others, right? So what would Aristotle tell us about the current pandemic? Friendship is important, right? Friendship is really important. You know, I mentioned the business about social animals a lot. As you noted, we don't cease to be social animals just because we're all indoors, right? I'm hesitant to make, you know, give any particular Aristotelian action items, right? But I think whatever we choose to do, putting others and the concerns of others in the forefront, and recognizing our nature as social animals would be paramount, right?
I'm glad you brought up friendships, because this is something in the past few years I've been thinking a lot about. I think today in our culture, this is one of our sort of disorders, especially when we talk about friendships among men. I think often of just Justin Timberlake and Jimmy Fallon, who I think are a great model for male friendships today, and they've actually gotten a lot of grief for that. And I think that the grief that they've received is a symptom of really a sickness in our culture. Yeah. Why does Aristotle spend so much time talking about friendship? How can we use his description of friendship as a prophetic critique of how friendships are thought of today?
Yeah. Oh gosh. So, I don't know how much I can say about Jimmy Fallon or Justin Timberlake, but I can.
Well, it's just, I mean, again, they're both Hollywood, you know, stars,
yeah.
But it's clear that they don't have a Hollywood friendship. Like, they're real friends,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
they spend
yeah.
time together, and they're
yeah.
unapologetic about
yeah.
it. And I mean, when I stop and think, all right, how many, men in our, public,
yeah.
Can I think of who are really truly friends?
Yes, yeah.
When
yeah.
you can really see, and there's a couple other like LeBron James and
sure.
Dwayne Wade, but I mean, I think you could have a very small list of men who are you can tell are really friends,
yeah.
and they're not just using each other
yeah.
in the Hollywood sense.
Yeah.
But we can just use that as again an example of where
yeah.
our culture is, and I think Aristotle would have a lot
yeah.
to say.
Oh, absolutely.
In critique. So what? How did he define friendship?
Yeah. No. Good. So, you know, for Aristotle, what's you know absolutely required for friendship is the reciprocal willing of goods, right? So I will your good, you will my good, right? In some sense, famously, he gives us, you know, three, you know, types of friendships, right? So we've got, depending on what takes center stage, right? So if, the goods that bring us together are pleasant, and that's the basis for the relationship, it's a friendship of pleasure. You know, maybe you and I like playing tennis together. You know, maybe you and I like, you know, reading Augustine together or something like that. Because very pleasant, right? So, but or if the goods, as you alluded to earlier, are useful, right? So, you know, I'm a business partner. You know, you're my business partner. I help you out. You help me out, right? Then this is a friendship of utility. But finally, you know, if the good that brings us together is the good of, you know, just trying to be the best that we can, right, and genuine concern for the other for their own sake, you know, not because they're pleasant, not because they're useful, but for their own sake in the pursuit of what is genuinely good, you know, that is what Aristotle calls a friendship of virtue, right? And so, you know, it's not that friendships of utility or friendships of pleasure are in any way pejorative. You know, he doesn't think as in bad things. You know, he doesn't think that they're bad at all. You know, they're clearly a part of life, but he does think that friendships of virtue are just better. You know, they're objectively higher. You know, going back to your point about contemporary culture, here's something, and I've seen students react strongly to this in a positive way. It's like this idea of, you know, loving and being loved for your own sake in pursuit of what is genuinely good. It's like, well, that's that's how we're wired, right? And you mentioned that it's kind of a negative aspect, maybe a negative symptom of our culture. I think if that's genuinely the view, you know, that men cannot or should not have close friendships, I think that's catastrophic. That's disastrous, you know, because we're wired for that. You know, to give you a sense for Aristotle's view here. So what is at the core of virtue friendship is this reciprocal love, this reciprocal willing of the good in a way that's enduring, right? So it's not, you know, he says in his chapters on friendship that, you know, it's not just beginning to treat each other as friends that makes a friendship. You know, there needs to be some time. You know, there needs to be a certain shared history, right? You need to learn about each other, you know. And what is most characteristic of friendship in Aristotle's view? Suzdane is the Greek, pardon, you know, I probably have a Greek quota here. Suzdane, literally, living together. He doesn't mean, like living under the same household. But you could translate more loosely, like, you know, spending time, you know, sharing your life, right? This is what's most characteristic of friendship, just spending time with the other person, right? And, not surprisingly, that takes time, you know. So I think, you know, thinking about the culture here, I don't know what Joe Blow or Jane Doe thinks about this, but I can certainly say that the wider culture is generally not conducive to that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all super busy, and everybody's got all these things. Everybody's running at 100 miles per hour. So I remember this student who I mentioned earlier. Wonderful thing about having bright students is that they do your work for you, right? So one of the things that this student mentioned, it was like, well, gee, you know, it's like it almost seems like you need to prioritize friendship the way you might prioritize like health or sleep or something like this.
Right.
And I'm thinking, yeah, that's right. It's like, cause, like many of those things that are important, but not urgent, if you don't make time for it, it's not going to happen.
Right.
Right. So I think that's,
can you give a concrete example of what, a friendship of virtue would look like as opposed to the other types of friendships that you mentioned? How would that look concretely?
Yeah, no, good. So I think here's something, let me name two things that are pretty concrete, one of which might jive better or worse with our current culture, and a second which will jive, I think, very well with our current culture. So what is required for friendship of virtue? You need the right moral outlook, and you need a shared moral outlook, right? Let me give you an example that I think is fairly clear. If you have, say, I have a friend who is a narco. So let's call him Pablo. So suppose that I'm friends with Pablo in some sense of friends, right? But that I, you know, I might have a number of objections to, you know, what he does for a living. So there's going to be a pretty clear limit on how close we can be, right? Because, you know, his conception of the good might be so different from mine that in trying to will my good, you know, he might do all kinds of atrocious things. And so, okay, Pablo, that's a little too close for comfort, right? So what do you, you know, the first thing that you need is you need a shared moral outlook. Mm-hmm. And the part that might jive a little bit less, less well with the culture, you need the right moral outlook, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, that comes in degrees. But so all this to say, so that when you've got the shared moral outlook, you know, you can essentially help each other, you know, in the pursuit of virtue, right? So, you know, we're talking here in Catholic context. You know, I think very concrete, clear example of this is people who might share the Catholic faith, right? It's like we both might recognize that God is our final end, and we want to kind of share that and help each other with that. Now, that's all still very abstract, you know. Talking about, you know, the second thing that I think does jive very well with our culture is just, or at least with what I think people in our culture want, not what they do. What does jive very well is this idea of caring for another person for their own sake. And just spending time, mm-hmm. right? So yesterday I had a beer with a good friend, and it was just like, why are we getting together? Just because, mm-hmm. right? It's like, and we are just talking about whatever, whatever is going, what's going on with you? What's up with this? What's up with that? It's not transactional, right? So I think, being intentional about that kind of thing requires, again, to get very concrete, as you noted, requires what my student mentioned is being intentional about it, right? Mm-hmm. Scheduling it in like you might schedule going to the gym or whatever else, right? And I think especially in Catholic contexts, I think that there's a lot of room for growth, right? In this, and I think many people appreciate that kind of thing. I certainly do.
I think that's an important critique. This idea of friends having a shared moral vision, and that you would critique Pablo because he's not living a flourishing life. That's the exact opposite of what our culture says, which is if you're my friend, you have to enable me in whatever I want to do.
Oh goodness, yeah.
Because I think this is good, and for you to critique me is not a true vision of love. Do whatever you want as long as it makes you feel good. So Aristotle is presenting the exact opposite there. I don't know exactly what the question is, but what then are the implications there? What's the next step of these different visions of what the responsibility of a friend is to a friend?
So you're thinking like if I'm friends with Pablo and I want to be better or no,
your responsibility to Pablo, our culture would say is to encourage him to do what he wants because he feels that that's what makes him flourishing.
Happy or whatever.
Which is the exact opposite of what Aristotle would say.
Yeah, no, that's right. So it's interesting, Aristotle has these striking passages, not about Pablo the Narco, but might as well be, So he's talking about how if you have a friend who has lost his way, you should try to help him recover his character more than you would help him recover his property or something like this. It's like, so, my best friend maybe loses his car, my best friend loses some important legal document or whatever. If I'm in a position to help him, I'm going to bend over backwards to help him, right? Where Aristotle says, well, suppose he loses his character, right? You got to bend over backwards, to help your friend, regain his character. You might become a pain in the rear for your friend, right? But Aristotle would tell us, that's part of what true friendship requires, right? So, of course, Aristotle doesn't, the passages there are, very suggestive. He doesn't go into as much detail as one would like. But I think it's, from my standpoint, there's a delicate balance between really wanting to will the good for your friend and respecting their freedom, right? So that's a hard balance. But I think from the Aristotelian view, there's always in the back of your mind is going to be, I want the real good for my friend, right? So I don't want some counterfeit good. I don't want some cheap thrill for my friend. I want the real thing for him.
This is an example of, I often think if you could put Aristotle in a time machine and bring him to the 21st century and he could see our culture, and we've talked about, the idea of true love, willing that person is good, how different that is from what our culture says today, different understanding of friendship. I wonder if his mind would just blow up when he would look, if he were to look around today and see how we're, in a sense, our American culture is living the exact opposite of what he prescribed. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Oh gosh, that's hard. But I what comes to mind is this. There's this contrast is probably overdrawn, but overdrawn contrasts are sometimes useful. So, famously, you've got Plato in the Republic, who is wanting this like total overhaul of society, right? Mm-hmm. It's like we want philosophers should be kings, and we should share our wives. Ask the women how they like that. It's like and all these different things. And in a way, Aristotle's position, and again, this is overstated, is a little bit closer to the ground, right? And in a way, so I think maybe a cheerful reading of, you know, Aristotle's reaction to contemporary culture, insofar as I can envision that, is something like, well, you know, I did tell you that pleasure is corrupting, you know, I did tell you that pleasure appears good when it is not, and I did tell you that most people are driven primarily by desire for pleasure, right? You know, to that extent, you know, if we're talking about, you know, problems with, you know, addiction or the hookup culture or whatever, in some sense, that's no surprise. But from another angle, it's like, okay, well, you know, work with what you have, you know, work with the people around you, right? You know, there's these suggestive passages also at the end of the Ethics, where Aristotle notes, rightly, it's like, well, gee, you know, at least, you know, a person can help, I forget if he mentions children or friends or just children or just friends, but you can help them. You have influence over a certain amount of people, right? Mm-hmm. And, to the extent that you can genuinely will their good, you know, that's, we're all better off for it, I think.
Let's talk about you for a minute.
Sure.
You're dedicating your life to thinking and writing about Aristotle, in particular his virtues. Yeah. What draws you to him? Why is he important for you personally, and why is that topic important?
Yeah. No. Good. So I think I remember first reading the Ethics when I was a freshman, and I remember reading book one, chapter one, and thinking, I have no idea what's going on here. So, I went to Catholic University, and, you know, not surprisingly, you get tidbits of Aristotle in different places.
Yeah.
But I think, one of the things that did it for me, well, a couple things. So one, I remember, you know, there was a class a couple semesters later where I had a better sense of what was going on. I remember beginning to read through the Ethics and just having this sense of like, wow, you know, this is so tremendously rich, and I just want to understand this whole thing. And it's like you've got this vision of this amazing, you know, panorama of what the happy life is supposed to look like, and I'm thinking to myself, I just want to understand this. But I think also too, you know, I was reading a reasonable amount of St. Thomas as an undergrad, and I think it was also just trying to understand Thomas. Mm-hmm. It's like, because there's so much Aristotle, you know, sure, throughout the work of Aquinas, you know, implicit or explicit. And I figured, it's like, you know what, you know, let me just spend some time, you know, trying to think about Aristotle. Mm-hmm. I think also too, as I kind of met, you know, grew a little bit more in my own philosophical training, I guess, you know, seeing the kind of respect and admiration that Aristotle drew from all kinds of people, mm-hmm, you know, so not just the Thomists, right, but, you know, all kinds of secular thinkers who, you know, take Aristotle very seriously, right? And, you know, that's I find that attractive, right? Because it's, I think, you know, going back to the business about Martin Luther, right? So it's like, look, you know, if this, you know, to the Aristotelian, is a reflection of our common human nature, right? This recognition that, you know, that friendship is a good, that truth is a good, all these things. And I think even more specifically, so I was very interested, and I am very interested, in, you know, Aristotle's understanding of desire, right? So, because I think at the end of the day, you know, one way of thinking about virtue is about shaping the way we love, right? And what we love. In a way, it's very Augustinian, mm-hmm, right? He wouldn't quite put it in those terms, but I think it is.
I had a similar experience, I think, as a freshman in college with Plato. I was at first baffled by the whole dialogue part. I thought I was expecting something more like Descartes, which we got later on in the semester. So I was initially sort of turned off. and didn't really understand what was going on.
Yeah.
And then, but you said that later on you sort of realized, oh, there's some real wisdom here.
Yeah.
I think this is where our experiences diverge, because when we finally, after, you know, the professor for weeks and weeks and weeks anticipating that we'll finally get to Socrates' definition of justice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we get to justice is giving to the other what is owed. And I was like, that's it? Like,
underwhelmed.
Yeah, it's exactly. I was like, this is what we've been waiting for. Like, my 5-year-old, you know, friend's child could tell me that, you know, when they're fighting over the same toy. So I have to admit that my experience then sort of like, this philosophy stuff is nonsense. It took me years to sort of come back to it. And like, all right, maybe Plato's got something to say. I'd mentioned at the beginning that you're the executive director of the Houston Institute.
Yeah.
What is the Houston Institute and what is its mission?
Yeah, so the Houston Institute is an academic nonprofit. The mission of the Houston Institute is to help the people of Rice University think deeply about the best way to live. So how do we do that? You know, so we do this primarily through, you know, reading groups. We sponsor lectures. We sponsor 4-credit courses in the philosophy department. And even though we're very much have a particular interest in the natural law tradition, we are deliberately pluralistic. So, you know, the more diverse our audience is, the better, right? So, to the extent that people want to have serious conversations about big ideas with fun people, mm-hmm. I hope we can bring fun people. I think it's the more the merrier. So that's what we do. We've been running a number of reading groups over the summer. That's been delightful. You know, we're about to start a 3-week series on Cicero's On Duties. Mm-hmm. Starting tonight. So that'll be lots of fun.
Good. Well, Dr. Sines, thank you very much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
Are you looking for answers to life's biggest questions like, who are we? What does it mean to be a human person? What does it mean to be a Catholic in America today? How can I be a prophetic voice in our culture? The Center for Faith and Culture at the University of St. Thomas in Houston now offers its MA in Faith and Culture online. This program transforms students by immersing you in the historical, cultural, and theological patrimony of the Catholic tradition, so that you'll go out into the dominant American culture and leaven it with the good news. Students can audit courses, get an 18-hour certificate, or go for the entire MA program. For more information, Google Center for Faith and Culture, the University of St. Thomas.